case number 10-1257, Feature Group IP West LLC et al. Petitioners versus Federal Communications et al. Mr. McCullough for petitioners, Mr. Joshi for respondents, Mr. Harris for interveners.
May it please the court. My name is Scott McCullough. I'm counsel for the petitioners, Feature Group IP entities. The facts of the case below, and as explained in the briefing, is that the Feature Group IP entities were all formed. One of them is indeed operating, purely to be local exchange carriers. The court is, of course, well familiar with the structure of the Communications Act. I know that this panel, or at least certain members of it, have seen certain, or indeed several, intercarrier compensation issues. And so I'm not going to sit here and try to give an extensive background, because the panel members are probably even more familiar with it than I am. But it is very meaningful that the Feature Group IP entities were formed only to be LECs, to provide two specific services: telephone exchange service or exchange access. They were not formed to provide and do not provide telephone toll service as inter-exchange carriers, nor do they provide any enhanced or information services. They're purely LECs. For 10 years, Feature Group IP has been trying to secure a ruling on the appropriate intercarrier compensation as between the Feature Group IP LECs and other LECs with whom they interconnect.
And isn't that the subject of the current rulemaking now?
It is. It was also the subject of the 1999 ISP declaratory ruling, so it's 2001 it's NPRM, under, the 2004 it's under, NPRM.
It's under consideration by the Commission now in ongoing rulemaking, right?
It is, and so it has been serially under consideration.
Right. I got you. But isn't your appropriate remedy then, since they've delayed so long, to file a petition for writ of mandamus instead of a forbearance petition, which the Commission says does not include the authority to issue a declaratory judgment?
Well, certainly we could have sought mandamus, much like CORE did.
Exactly.
But that does not mean we have to.
No, but that's the traditional route to deal with agency delay.
It is,
and the Commission says that, look, a forbearance petition is a much narrower procedure. There is no authority in considering a forbearance petition to issue declaratory relief of any kind, and they just looked at your request and said no. This isn't the right mechanism for that.
First of all, I would take issue with the characterization that it was a request for declaratory ruling. Congress put Section 160.10 of the Communications Act in effect for a certain reason, so that an entity could go and seek relief from an obligation.
You know, from the enforcement of a provision of a statute.
Yes.
Right, and you want them to not enforce subsection G.
We wanted the Commission,
51G.
If access charges apply, as between the LECs in issue, we wanted the Commission to functionally treat the communications in issue just like it does traditional telephone toll.
Right, and that's the subject of the ongoing rulemaking.
That is one of the things in the ongoing rulemaking. It is also one of the things that has been before the Commission in rulemakings, declaratory rulings, for over 10 years. Our point is that the forbearance relief is there, and I do not think that a commission, the Communications Commission, can responsibly say we're not going to decide something that is seminal to a forbearance request because we have it over here and we've had it for 10 years.
The Commission just assumed that 251G applied and then decided not to forbear because it said it would leave a regulatory gap. It would not be in the public interest. And let me ask you the question this way. You spent a lot of time in your brief arguing the Commission can't make that assumption, right, that it actually has to decide the question. Suppose we don't agree with you about that. Well, then what? Do you at that point, do you lose?
I do not believe so. First of all, we think that you cannot reasonably or responsibly make it what is necessarily, in our perspective, an invalid or illegal assumption.
Yeah, but my question was, assume you're wrong about it. I don't mean assume you're wrong about the way you described it. Assume you're wrong about the way that you're challenged to what the commission did, which is that it assumed that 251G applies.
Well, then we go into the kind of analysis.
Maybe right, maybe wrong, but it assumed it, and then it said, well, we're not going to forbear for the reasons it gave.
Then we get into the merits that the FCC used to deny forbearance. Its principal reason was its prior core forbearance decision, which this court had an opportunity to.
Do you disagree that if it did forbear under its assumption that there would be no access charges, there would be no... In other words, if it removed 251G, then there would be nothing preserving the pre-act rates, whatever they were, charges. That's their point.
And that is the regulatory.
That would create this regulatory gap, which wouldn't be in the public interest.
There are two problems with that.
Yeah, what are they?
The first problem is, obviously, we don't think there is one, because, again, this is LEC to LEC track.
There isn't one what?
Second.
There isn't one what?
There is not a regulatory gap.
And why is that?
Because this is LEC to LEC traffic.
That's the merits.
And if the carve-out, the assumed carve-out from 251G is removed through forbearance, it would once again be the kind of telecommunications that is subject to 251B5. The whole premise here that the commission used in the core forbearance case and here was that it can only change 251G by rule.
The consequences of forbearance are not to move your rates into 251B5, but to mean there are no rates at all. That's the commission's view.
That was the commission's analysis, and right. We disagree with it. We think that, indeed, it would put us back within 251. There was alternative relief that we sought as well. Even if you did assume that 251G applied, what we requested was that the commission merely treat the communications in issue as it does traditional telephone toll, with the LECs being engaged in jointly provided access.
The commission says you didn't raise that.
Well, we would again take issue, and I think I would consume all of my time providing the citations to the record that we did in our response brief and in our initial brief. We did mention it in the initial filing, and we most certainly made it clear in the middle and in the end of the case that what we were asking, if the commission chose to not completely forbear from 251G, than to merely treat this like telephone toll, so that all of the LECs involved would be jointly engaged in exchange access service, sending the bill to the access customer. I would like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may, subject to any further questions.
Good morning. I'm Nandan Joshi for the Federal Communications Commission. I think it's pretty clear Feature Group IP thought of Section 10 as a sort of regulatory catch-all that replaces other types of proceedings if it's unhappy with the pace of those proceedings. Section 10, in fact, just requires the Commission to analyze the merits of a forbearance petition within the statutory deadline, and that is what the Commission did here. It concluded that Feature Group IP, assuming its traffic was subject to Section 251G, had not shown that forbearance from those regulatory obligations would satisfy the three criteria set forth in Section 10. The Commission did this for two separate reasons. One is that the premise of Feature Group IP's forbearance petition was that forbearing from 251G would not automatically cause the underlying traffic to become regulated under Section 251B5. That's the reciprocal compensation rules. That was a decision the Commission made in the core communications decision. And on page 23 of Feature Group IP's opening brief, they admit that core was correctly decided. The only distinction they attempted to make was that the traffic at issue here was much narrower, was much less sweeping than in core, and that somehow made a difference in terms of the rulemaking requirement that Section 251G imposes to move traffic from G to another regulatory provision. The commission as well determined that feature group IP had not really presented any evidence to support making a finding that the three forbearance criteria are met.
I just want to make sure I understand this. Under 251G, that's a transitional rule, and the pre-96 rates remain in effect until replaced by commission regulations?
Well, it's not the exact rates, but the set of rules that govern access charges stay in effect until the commission replaces it affirmatively.
And if the commission hasn't promulgated regulations and you forbear from applying 251G, there's nothing.
There's no rate regulation of access charges, which
right.
means they could, for example, a LEC that was imposing access charges could file a tariff with any rates it chose, and the commission could not deny that tariff because there would be no rate regulation. That's the regulatory void the commission was speaking of.
Does the commission still argue that UTEX doesn't have standing here?
We maintain that they haven't shown it in their opening brief. UTEX claims standing.
Yeah. They say they pay access charges in Texas.
Yes, they do.
You don't challenge that anywhere.
No, we don't. And they also claim,
Let me just finish my question. So you don't challenge that. If the commission had granted the forbearance petition, then I assume there would be no access charges in Texas, correct? Because in response to Judge Randolph, you just said that there would be no regulatory scheme at all.
No, if the commission granted forbearance under the regulatory void theory,
right.
What would happen is the incumbent LEC that Feature Group IP is sending its traffic to would be able to charge whatever access charges it would like to without regard to whether it was just and reasonable, because there would be no rate regulation on the incumbent
LEC. I see.
So that would be the harm there. Feature Group IP.
What would be the harm?
So
that would be UTEX's harm.
It would be harm to UTEX, yes.
Right, so doesn't it have standing? Doesn't that give it standing?
No, what I was saying was the grant of forbearance would harm UTEX because they would actually be paying more because the access charges they were paying would no longer be rate regulated.
Right.
The harm to UTEX that they claim is based on liability that they have to pay to AT&T for the access charges that AT&T is currently imposing. Right. But on page the reason it's somewhat a little confusing is on page 23 of their opening brief, and they made the same argument before the commission, I believe, is that they claim that their liability to AT&T is not based on the FCC's rules or the Communications Act, but 23 of their opening brief. Here, I'll quote what they say. The Texas Commission went out of its way. This is an imposing liability on UTEX. Went out of its way to emphasize that it was not in that case ruling on what the Act and FCC rules require, but only on what the agreement provides. And that's the existing interconnection agreement that UTEX has with AT&T. So it begs the question of how the FCC's declaration of whatever the rules are at the federal level would have impacted the Texas PUC's interpretation of the terms of an existing interconnection agreement. Perhaps there's some explanation there, but we don't see it in any of Feature Group IP's filings to this court. So that's the basis of our standing argument.
I see. Okay, thank you.
I would like to point out just Mr. McCullough mentioned the partial forbearance petition, the so-called partial forbearance petition. We explained that the commission denied that on reconsideration for three independent grounds. They only challenged one of those grounds. They did not respond to that argument in the reply brief.
You mean the argument that it wasn't raised?
They responded to the argument that it wasn't raised. We don't think they provided any convincing showing that they raised a forbearance request with respect to their so-called partial forbearance theory. But they also haven't responded to the fact that the arguments they did raise are really an argument that the commission should interpret its existing rules. It's more of a declaratory ruling type of argument than a forbearance request, and they also don't respond to the commission's explanation that they once again provided no evidence to support any of the forbearance findings that they claim the commission should have made. I covered all the points I'd like to make today.
I have one question, a procedural question. That after the initial denial, the petitioners filed a request for reconsideration.
Yes.
And in that, they asked for partial forbearance. Was that the idea?
They claimed that the commission should have granted partial forbearance because they had raised that issue below. They did not cite any record evidence where they had raised it below.
Here's my question. When they then petition for judicial review, are they restricted to the arguments that they put forward in their motion for reconsideration?
Well, they are restricted to the arguments they've put in the record below at some point. I don't know that they are.
There's some cases that are floating around. I haven't researched it, but certainly in FERC cases, if you haven't raised it in a petition for rehearing, you can't raise it in the court, no matter what you raised earlier.
I'm not familiar with FERC's jurisdictional statute. I think the practice for the FCC is the under Section 47 U.S.C. 405, the argument has to be raised below at some point in the proceeding. I don't know if it has to be re-raised at reconsideration. I'm not aware of any case law that says it has
There's
to be
a lot of old
re-argued.
Cases when Judge Skelly Wright and Bazelon were on this court dealing with 405, and I just haven't gone. Children's advertising cases or something.
I'm not familiar with that. I believe FERC may have a requirement that parties seek reconsideration.
Oh, it does.
Okay, the FCC does not have that requirement, unless you want to raise a new issue that you haven't raised before. The FCC statute doesn't have that
except
requirement.
Except that there's some case law suggesting that we should construe 405 as a requirement. Anyway.
Yeah. All right. Okay. The court has no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. How much? He has some time left, right? Mr. McAuliffe has some time left?
We have the intervener.
Oh, the intervener. My apologies. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Yeah.
Interveners AT&T, CenturyLink, and Verizon agree with the petitioner that it's essential for the FCC to establish clear rules governing intercarrier compensation for VoIP traffic. But that far-reaching issue simply is not presented in this proceeding. The only question here is whether Feature Group IP, assuming it has standing, met the statutory criteria for forbearance. And
you
as the FCC...
Do you think it did have standing?
What's that?
You think it does have standing?
We don't think they have standing. For the same reasons that Mr. Joshi said.
All right. Well, go ahead then. Yeah.
And the only point I would add, in response to Judge Randolph's question from earlier about how Section 251G works, the language of the statute says that the pre-existing access obligations apply until explicitly superseded by regulation.
Right.
So there is no backstop default if the FCC granted forbearance, and a forbearance petition is not a regulation, it's removal of regulation. So if there are no additional questions for the interveners. We would ask the court to.
So is the position, is it your view that they lack standing because these rates, these access charges they pay in Texas are pursuant to an agreement rather than imposed by the agency?
That's right. And, Your Honor, we think there's a causation problem, too, in that the Texas Commission, in the order cited in Feature Group IP's reply brief, at pages 6 to 8, it listed the relevant FCC orders that justified its decision. It didn't make any mention of the orders at issue in this case. So while we think Feature Group IP can plausibly allege that they are injured by the Texas proceeding, I don't think they've even attempted to show how that is linked to the orders that they're challenging here.
Well, what effect would forbearance have on the Texas situation?
I think it would generally apply on a going-forward basis only.
What effect would it have?
I think it would mean that in a future agreement they would not have to pay access on this.
Well, isn't that where their injury comes from?
Right, but again, I don't think that injury was caused by the orders that are being challenged in this case, as opposed to other FCC orders or pre-existing regulatory.
Well, what about the statute? What about 251G? That's what they want forbearance of.
Right.
So if the commission decides not to enforce 251G, what happens in Texas?
Then the parties would have to litigate under what they perceive to be the governing.
But they couldn't be required to pay access charges. right? Because there'd be no that's the regulatory gap that would be created by forbearing.
Right? I think that would be right. State commissions are bound by what the FCC does.
Correct. So then why don't they have standing? Isn't that their injury? And in fact, the statute says that the state agency can't enforce a statute that the commission forbears, correct?
That is correct.
So then I don't understand why they don't have standing.
Also, even wholly apart from the Texas Commission, their claim is that the commission, the FCC, should have determined that 251G didn't apply to them. Why don't they have standing to make that claim?
Right, Your Honor, I think our primary point in the brief was that this was, especially in light of Rule 28A7, in light of the core decision, in light of the Sierra Club decision, we think that it was a failure of proof on their part to come forward with enough in their opening brief to do what this court has repeatedly said, which is that petitioners have to establish their standing at the earliest point in their brief.
Yeah, but you see, the commission didn't anywhere object to their key arguments in their brief, namely that they pay these access charges in Texas and that they're seeking forbearance of 251G. What more would they do they need to say that in an F? Well, you don't challenge either. Well, obviously they're seeking forbearance, and with respect to Texas, the commission didn't challenge that.
Your Honor, we think that in a case like this where the FCC says that the regulatory obligations are uncertain, we think that the key path to standing would be by showing that you're actually injured by that uncertainty. And that's what the court said in American Chemistry Council. That's what the court said in CORE. And we think, aside from just saying that it's not entering markets, and aside from very broadly referring to the Texas proceedings, we just don't think Future Group carried its burden on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now, how much time does Mr. McAuliffe have?
A little over 7 minutes.
Okay, go ahead. Would you start with standing, too, and explain why you have standing? Yeah.
Yes, first of all, under the cases, there need not be an expansive description or even affidavits regarding or approving standing in the initial brief if it is evident from the record below.
Don't start that way. Tell us about Texas.
In Texas, Future Group IP has an existing agreement that has been in place since 2001.
Right.
That agreement provides that no compensation is due or payable for traffic to or from any enhanced service providers. Nonetheless, the Texas Commission interpreted that contract to provide that UTEX, the Future Group IP entity in Texas, must pay access charges to AT&T for ESP, VOIP type traffic that was deemed to be not local. What would happen if forbearance had been granted with regard to the existing agreement? That existing agreement has a change of law provision. And therefore, as a result of forbearance, we would have been able to, and indeed entitled to, an amendment to the current agreement, removing any access obligation that had been found by the Commission. Further, Future Group IP has been embroiled in a single arbitration proceeding for a replacement agreement since 2002 before the Texas Commission. The central issue in that case is whether access charges are due for VOIP services. For a very long time, the Texas Commission abated that case over our objection, pending an FCC decision in its 2005 rulemaking on whether access charges applied to VOIP. Now, as we know, the FCC didn't decide.
Did you tell us anything about this change of law provision in your briefs? This is very interesting.
In my defense, Your Honor, actually, this particular argument wasn't really raised by the other side, so
your obligation is to demonstrate standing in your opening brief.
This is true, and as we demonstrated below, we have been receiving access bills from not only AT&T but other ILECs virtually since we opened our doors and began providing service. We have been subject to this uncertain thing, and we have been trying to obtain certainty as to whether this obligation ever existed for a very long time. And I think receiving an access bill that you assert very strongly is not due or payable and should not be due or payable is a kind of harm that is subject to redress by appealing to the court. Had the FCC acted, that would have ended. It would have ended with regard to the current interconnection agreement. It would have ended with regard to the replacement agreement that is still under pending arbitration at the Texas Commission. Further, with the other feature group IP entities, as we expanded into other states, it would have been clear that they too would have not been subject to access charges. I'd like to return for just a second to this absence of regulation thing, and indeed the theory that the FCC used in the initial core forbearance order, if I may. Let me remind you that the analysis in the initial core forbearance order was never reviewed by this court because core was poured out on the standing issue. What the FCC is saying is that under 251G, it can only change the scope of traffic carved out of 251B5 through 251G through rulemaking.
Isn't that what 251G says?
Well, the 251G also says that, but at the same time, Section 160 says that the commission can forbear from enforcing any regulation, and there's only two exceptions. The first exception is 251C, which is not 251G. The other is the 271. And so, in theory, it is indeed true that the commission could forbear from enforcing 251G. Now, what would happen in that instance? The commission and AT&T assert...
The commission doesn't disagree with you about that.
Well, what would happen if forbearance did occur from 251G? The commission and AT&T assert, well, that means that AT&T could just charge feature group IP whatever it wants. I submit to the court that this is looking at the forbearance relief that would be granted from the wrong fashion. If you look at what is being granted in forbearance, it is as to feature group IP. Feature group IP would have had its obligation, its assumed obligation, to pay access charges removed. It would not have freed AT&T to charge anything it wants. We would not have to pay access charges. Even if there is an absence of regulation, it would only apply to feature group IP. And at best, it would mean bill and keep. Something the FCC advocated from 2001 forward for quite some time. So the sky would not fall had forbearance been granted, and even if, contrary to our assertions, there was an absence of regulation. The forbearance relief would have been granted as to feature group IP, not as for AT&T. I'll be happy to answer.
Do you have anything else?
No, sir, I do not.
Do you have any questions? No. Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
Stand, please. Honorable court announcement is adjourned until Thursday morning at 9:30.